Good evening and welcome to the Sunday Night Potluck. This is Matt with the Sick of Nature show, and I have with me in the studio this week Richard Nelson, who I'll be visiting with about whatever nature stuff comes to mind at the time. I wanted to thank everybody for joining us this evening, and it's, you know, been a pretty nice Sunday. Days like this in October sort of feel like a gift, you know. You're ready for the rains and the different pleasantness of fall, I suppose, with the wind and the rain. But then you just have this day out of the blue where it's sunny and warm. Was up Indian River with my kids today, this afternoon, and ran into a couple different sets of people that were hiking down from the Sisters, and I hope lots of other folks got out to enjoy the weather. Yesterday was pretty nice also, as I recall, and so I appreciate these times and appreciate everybody listening, and also the people that's over the last couple of weeks and before that have shared their observations with me. A couple of things that I'll mention this evening were things that other people had taken the time out to observe and then share, and so I really appreciate folks doing that. And I want to welcome Richard to the show tonight. He joined me at the last minute. I had a couple other guests lined up, but ended up running into the sea cucumber dive fishery this weekend. So we'll get them on at another time. But thanks for stepping in here at the last minute to join me.
It's always great to be here. And every conversation with you about our amazing natural world is always a pleasure, Matt. So well, thank you.
Yeah, it's always fun to see what's going on. One of the things that I actually have a couple different people to thank. Somebody sent an email to the Sitka Bird email list within the last week, I believe, and they had heard sandhill cranes flying over their house out at near Kramer Avenue, and I happened to go out that evening as well, and about an hour later, and heard those cranes flying over my neighborhood in near Market Center. Then just a couple days ago, I talked to somebody else who had been over anchored up in a bay, and I don't remember the name of the bay off the top of my head, at Admiralty, and it sounded like around the same time. And she told me that as they were anchoring up and the sun was setting, they heard this strange call, and then they looked up and there were these cranes. And she said she lost count at about 200, but there were still more cranes flying over. And I think the sandhill cranes, I think they mostly migrate on the inside. They go through Gustavus and Yakutat, but yeah. I think they come down through Chatham instead of out here. So it's kind of fun when we do get to see a few. I think they're probably nesting on cruise off a pair or two.
Once in a great while, you see sandhill cranes out there. It's pretty rare.
Yeah, and nobody's actually documented nesting, but in a couple of different summers along the Edgecombe Trail, there were cranes in, I mean, when I went there and saw them, there were tracks all over the place. I didn't know what they were. I'd never seen a crane here before. Of course, I knew about them, but I didn't recognize just these big bird tracks.
Yeah,
and I was like,
yeah.
Well, would herons have been up here in these muskeg puddles? And then I heard this strange call that I didn't recognize. And of course, you know, cruise offs, that flat, open muskeg stuff. And I was there with a group of other people. We weren't staying together, but I mean, their Elm Marine boat was coming to pick us up at 5. And I was like, well, should I go wander off the trail and risk not being able to find it very easily? I wasn't worried about getting lost completely, but you know, since I had a time, I got to go look. And so I went over there and looked, and there was a lone sandhill crane calling, and then it ended up flying off. And there was just way too many tracks for one bird to have made. So I suspect that this was kind of mid-August. And then I talked to somebody else that was doing, I guess Bike and Hike did some trips over there, and he was working for them. And he got some pictures of them in early July. There were cranes over there, and they were kind of doing he thought it maybe was the dancing, but I showed the pictures to somebody else, and that guy thought that it was maybe nest protection, you know, I guess cranes even will act like they're injured, you know, small birds. It's kind of funny to imagine cranes being worried about predators, but their young birds are really very small. So
right.
Distraction displays, I guess is what they call those. So that was kind of interesting, and certainly if there's been other reports suggestive of breeding over there, and they do breed in other, I think Prince of Wales has them in muskeg areas and stuff, so they're likely to breed over there at least occasionally, but it's such a big area that's not really, you know, except for the trail up Edgecombe and the trail over to Sea Lion Cove, there's not a lot of probably traffic, which is good, but you know, we just don't know what's there.
Yeah,
so,
right. Right.
That's always the thing. And then snow geese, I've seen two different flocks of snow geese and talked to a couple other people that have seen snow geese in the last couple of weeks. It's not one of those things where they probably go over every year, but if you don't happen to look up at the right time, and fortunately they call when they're flying, otherwise I probably would have missed both flocks that I saw. But they're very striking white birds, and if you get binoculars on them, if they're too high, you can't see it, but with binoculars you can. White birds with black, kind of black ends of their wings, so they're pretty distinctive that way. And I don't know that I've never heard of them landing in numbers in town. I've seen an individual bird here that sort of joined in with some other birds, but they must be landing somewhere, you know, they're migrating out here. They just don't happen to pick here, I guess. Today I got a report of a Eurasian widgeon out at Stargaven. I was able to go out there and look at that.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, a nice male Eurasian widgeon.
Beautiful bird.
Yeah, orange head with kind of a white stripe going up its forehead. I don't know how long it'll stick around, but it was out at the big pool, you know, the estuary pool there, kind of by the viewing platform. Last week I got to see the mother bear and a cub up kind of mostly in the deep grass, so you couldn't see them very well, but it was kind of fun to just watch those. I mean, there's probably not that many places in the world where you can kind of have, it's obviously impacted somewhat, but it's still a fairly natural environment, and just be able to, like, from your road, watch these bears out there.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And sometimes you can just see them fishing there in the river, stand on the bridge and watch them fishing. Oh, man, it's incredible.
Yeah, the bears are, and it was interesting how many people, I mean, I probably wouldn't have seen them except for there were three cars in front that had all stopped and were looking over there. And then I looked over there, and oh, sure. And then they hopped down into the kind of the creek lid, and that one that's on the north side of the estuary, just the little stream there. And they hopped down into that where they're out in the open a little bit, and they went back up into the grass. And many people just were stopping by. And I think I don't actually get out there very often. I don't drive very much, and so it's a lot further than I prefer to walk or bike. So, but it seems like a lot of people go out there and really enjoy watching the bears over the summer.
And it's good, you know. We talk about how the bears disappear in the tall meadow grass. I mean, it's a good cautionary note. It is so easy to walk up closer than you should to a bear because you simply don't know it's there in that tall grass. I mean, even a large bear can kind of vanish in that deep grass.
Well, that's where my brother had a story from this last summer, one of his trips that he shared on the show when he was a guest in where they were just minding their own business, having lunch in a tree that was kind of in a high point in an estuary meadow, and so a lot of grass and sedges there, and they're just minding their own business, and this bear charges right up to them and just making all sorts of noise, and it turned out what had happened is that she was walking up the estuary, probably caught wind of them, and she had a cub, and so she was just taking preventative, you know, precautions. She wanted to intimidate everybody so that the cub could get by, and then she left him alone and went on. But it was a little intimidating for them, I think.
And guess it would be.
He said that they probably wouldn't have even noticed it if it hadn't come up and done that. If it had just kept walking, that, you know, there was enough grass that unless they'd really been looking right there when she was walking by, they probably wouldn't have even seen her. So it's interesting, and it makes me wonder. You know, the one time I saw a bear in Totem Park, it was just off the trail by one of the places where the trail goes by the river, and it was just off the trail a little bit, and I walked right by it, stopped and took some pictures of some mushrooms on a tree, and then these other people came by, one of whom was a park employee with a rifle, and I was like, huh, and they go, yeah, there's a bear over here, and so I walked back and looked, how about that, there was a bear right there. It wasn't a big bear, but still, I walked right by it, and it was a little sort of, I mean, how many times have I done that? I don't know. I have no idea. In that particular instance, somebody else had noticed it, and so they were coming to check it out, and it was fun to watch it. But still, I guess that's the way that you don't want to. If you're noticing them in an encounter, it's not always a good thing. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, I remember a couple of times earlier in the summer in Totem Park that there were fresh bear droppings in the middle of, and the park. People at the park took those. It was when there were a lot of tourists around, and they took the droppings off the trail. And I thought, well, you know, that kind of deprives all these tourists of the thrill of knowing that a bear has walked right where they were walking. On the other hand, then had some conversations with some tourists in the park, and they definitely didn't share that perspective.
Yeah,
they really did not want to they were really scared.
Right. You know. Yeah, there's the unknown factor, you know.
Yeah. So it's probably the Park Service people are probably wise to clear those big piles off the trail.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, I guess what you become familiar with, you're less nervous about, for better or worse, you know. In a lot of cases, you don't need to be too worried, but maybe some of us get a little blasé about how we behave out in the woods. And, you know, like I said, my brother's story with them just minding their own business, and they did everything. I mean, they were having lunch. It wasn't like they were camping there or anything.
Yeah.
And it worked out all right. I mean, it was intimidating and scary for them for a few moments. And he said there was a certain amount of on edgeness after that, you know, where you've had that experience, and now it's, which maybe is good for us sometimes to have. I mean, we have a rather sanitized world that we live in most respects, in terms of natural threats, and I guess some of us, I haven't had a bad encounter, so, and here's hoping I don't, but.
Yeah, and of course there are people around town and all the neighboring towns that have had. But it's like, I don't claim to be an expert by any means about bears, but the people who are, you know, say that those charges are the bear is communicating.
Yeah.
And I guess maybe if you thought of bears as often being sort of like professional wrestlers that put their nose up to your face and scream at you and say, "You're in my territory. What is it about this that you don't understand? Move away."
Yeah.
And I think it's revolutionized my whole idea about bears, to learn that these behaviors are not a bear that's going to do you damage and stop short as an afterthought. It's exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
That the bear is trying to tell you something, and it really doesn't have any intention to harm you.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I always think it's really good perspective, and we're very lucky not to be all alone at the top of the food chain here. We get to experience what it's been like for most of humankind for all of human history, and only in recent times have we obliterated these things that could actually cause us harm.
Well, there was has been maybe 2 or 3 years ago now, there was a bear over by Brent's Beach Cabin that had started to get a little aggressive.
Yeah. Yep, remember
and
that.
I believe there was a couple of kayakers over there that took refuge in the cabin from this bear because it was, and then it was like standing over their kayak. And, you know, the thing is that I had been there maybe a week before or 2 weeks before, and I slept out on the beach at the cabin. I hadn't rented the cabin, so I just spent the night there, and then I walked around to about Mountain Point, I guess, and spent the night there out on the beach, and then walked back and got picked up. And that was right around the herring spawn time. And I remember reading in the paper, they thought that bear had probably come there during herring spawn and then had you know, access to food
in the
cabin.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, I was basically, I wasn't sleeping a lot that, I mean, it was a nice night. And so I, you know, sort of doze off by the fire and wake up and put more wood on and look at the stars and that sort of thing. But I didn't have food hung up like I'm supposed to, or, you know, it was just all with me. And, so, yeah, it made me sort of think, well, I'm glad that bear didn't bother me.
Yeah, right.
It certainly could have, because it was right there and right around, you know, just before those other folks had been there. So, you know, those kind of experiences, sort of almost near misses, make me wonder, you know, how often that's happening, and then I don't have any, you know, later feedback to find out that
it
was a near miss.
Yeah. So. Yeah, so there's a middle ground between being paranoid and being too casual about it.
Yeah,
you know, somewhere in the middle there.
I like the reminders that aren't really frightening to remind me to pay more attention.
There's two inventions that I'm really grateful for while we're on this subject, unplanned. One is obviously that everybody knows about is bear spray. What a fantastic invention that is. Partly because it hopefully is causing far fewer unnecessary shootings of bears, killings of bears and leaving of orphans and all that sort of stuff, cubs. But the other thing that I'm a bit of a preacher about that not that many people seem to be aware of yet is the electric fences that you can put around your camp. And I've had them for a number of years now, and I just love having that electric fence.
Yeah.
You can... You know, it uses 2D cell battery, flashlight batteries, It's very small and simple, a couple of pounds, 3 pounds or something like that, easy to carry around. And man, you can fall asleep and really sleep because you know it, and it delivers. Believe me, I've touched the wire often enough to know, because I never quite believe it.
Yeah.
It gives you an incredible zap, 5,000 volts.
Yeah.
Because it has a capacitor and builds up this big charge. Yeah. And they really work. And I always say it's the best $300 I ever spent.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard, I remember reading about them, and they were using them, I believe, on the, or sort of field testing them on the Kamchatka Peninsula. There was guy there doing it, and that the bears tend to lead with their nose. I mean, they're going along smelling, and so they get zapped right on sort of sensitive tissue there on their nose. And
they don't like it at all, and the bear fence comes with orange flagging, and you know, you tie flagging around to attract the bear's attention to the wire, which is white. It's not hard for the animal to see it. But it's an incredible invention, and I just can't say enough to recommend it to people when they go camping. These bears here are totally different from the ones up on Katmai, for example, which the bears on Katmai are completely fearless about people. They just treat people, as in many areas up there, as just an irrelevant part of the landscape. And I have camped up there next to bear highways, with bears walking by 3 feet away from my tent, and slept well inside this electric fence.
Yeah.
Around here, our bears are so much different from those up in that north country, because they really are timid and shy, overwhelmingly so. Nevertheless, there are, as you point out, you know, there are those bears occasionally that aren't harmless.
Yeah.
And what a great thing. You put up the electric fence.
Yeah.
I rarely camp anymore without putting it up.
Interesting.
You have to have moist ground.
Yeah.
Sand, dry sand isn't going to work, because the animal needs to have a ground on the bottom of its feet.
Moist is usually pretty easy to come
by
not
here, too.
I think. Yeah.
It's up in the interior that you have that problem.
Yeah. I know some people also carry around air horns to, you know, again, I think it's the shock and shock and awe sort of idea with the, same with the mace, that you get them stopped and turned around. And but I don't know. I mean, I don't know that I've heard any stories about people actually using that one way or the other, you know, successfully or not.
But the escalating noise, I've certainly experimented with it. Seeing bears, I remember out the road toward past the old pulp mill.
Yeah, yeah.
And picking salmon berries and seeing a bear on the road when I was up in the salmon berry thicket, and just experimenting with, okay, I'll make a noise at this level, and then I'll make it louder and louder.
Yeah.
And just seeing where, at which point the bear left.
Yeah.
And I've done it too with my skiff, just clanking the anchor chain or something, and just starting out soft and going up, and always hitting a point where the bear says, oh okay, I'm out of here.
Yeah, that's more than I want to deal with. Well, you know, we sort of got sidetracked on bears there,
didn't
which,
we though?
Which happens. But the other thing that has been around lately, which is a red-breasted nuthatch, and I think you told me you heard one recently.
Yeah, at Liz McKenzie's place on Lake Street, right?
I heard one at the park, and I know somebody else is at least a couple other people have been hearing them, and I have a recording here. I won't claim that this is going to be a really good recording of it, but they're so distinctive. I think it's worth people just hearing what they sound like. Let's see if this works here. This is one I recorded. I for about a year, I set up basically a parabolic dish pointed out my window, and I just recorded it directly in the computer all night. And because I was curious what was going on outside, I actually think what prompted it was I spent the night out in the yard once, and I heard these weird sounds that I didn't know what they were. And I thought, man, how much is going on out there when I'm just, you know, dead to the world? So I thought, well, we have this remarkable technology. I was telling you before the show about the iButtons that I have out, so
right.
You can do temperature data logging and trail cams that people have set out, so you can, you know, do some tracking of where animals and when they are, and see what they're doing. So all of these things are pretty amazing. But this should be a red-breasted nuthatch calling very quietly. You can kind of hear that beeping, in the background behind all the others.
Hmm.
of course, all the other normal birds for us, the chickadees and whatnot. But yeah, the nuthatches are, they have such a distinctive little kind of beeping call, and you often don't see them. I mean, they're fun to see if you do see them, but
right,
you'll just
the beautiful
hear them
little things, yeah,
as they're moving through. They do occasionally nest here. It seems like you had a
I had a
young
family a couple summers in a row at my house, and I've never seen one again since.
Yeah, yeah, and I remember Marge telling me that she saw a family in Totem Park in 1972 or 1973, and the reason that she remembered was because her family was visiting from New York, and they're pretty common in New York. And
right.
So that was before she really started doing a lot of birding, but that was interesting. And they're a species, I guess, that's eruptive, is you know, kind of like the finches are, the crossbills and the pine siskins. And so there'll be some years just lots of them and other years hardly any at all. And out here, I think they're more consistent, you know, along the mainland. Probably they migrate through there more consistently. But some years, you know, I know there's been years here where there have been quite a few at feeders. It was one of those species which, when I was just starting to kind of learn my birds and so forth, I had a feeder set up and a nuthatch was coming to it, and somebody's like, "Oh yeah, I've never seen a nuthatch." I'm like, "Really? I mean, all winter I've been having one come to my feeder. How rare are they?" But then I didn't see one for years after that. Kind of like, you know,
yeah, it's funny, and they really are worth listening for that little that little monotone sort of. Peeping, it's like you ratchet down the volume of an oyster catcher by about to a whisper, and there's the nuthatch, and they're just such pretty little things, and they're really worth watching for. I had this family at my house and nesting somewhere in the trees around there, and it was so cool to see them. And I remember one day seeing the three young ones, now almost fully grown. It was raining and they were miserable in the rain.
Yeah.
And I had these old-style windows with the little panes with wooden.
Yeah.
And all three of them grabbing onto those little wooden panes and huddling up against the window to get out of the rain for a little while.
Yeah.
Yeah, nuthatches. And I always watching and wishing they would show up again.
Come back. Well, the other bird that's sort of similar, I mean, they don't look much alike, but if you know, when you're in the forest and it's not that bright, you'll see creepers. And creepers sort of inevitably go up. I've seen them occasionally skip down, but they're head up and you know, they'll go sideways or whatever, but they're mostly
on the trunk of the tree. They're clamped onto the trunk of the tree like a little magnet bird.
And so they'll creep right up, and nuthatches will tend to, they'll go head down.
Yeah.
And they'll go down the tree. So
that's such an amazing thought about whatever evolutionary reasons there may be behind this, that one bird habitually works the little cracks and crevices in the bark by going up, and the other habitually does it by going down.
Yeah, and I guess that's, I mean, I'm not real familiar with other nut, there are definitely other nuthatches in other parts of North America,
right.
But I think they all kind of go downhill.
As far as I know, I certainly grew up around them.
Yeah, and the creepers, which I believe there are other creepers, but not in North America as far as I know.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So yeah, that was kind of fun. And then you were just telling me that you had a strange owl call recently. Somebody else sent an email to the bird list about they heard at least three owls calling near their house.
I saw that, yeah.
And weren't sure. And so this is one of the funny things. They had Sibley's, I think, iPhone, bird thing. And they were looking through there, and the closest they came up with was the northern hawk owl, which I think you said you've seen here once before.
I have, up on top of the mountain.
Yeah, Verstovia. And I don't know if it was the same bird or a different bird, but there was one that showed up out at Herring Cove for a while one year. I remember hearing about it. It was before I was paying any attention to birds, really. But I heard about that one. So they're really unusual here. Juno is excited to see them. They show up a little more often there, like Eagle Crest and so forth, but they're more of a northern bird. I emailed them back and said, well, probably it's Western screech owl. You know, that's by far most commonly observed owl here. Other owls have been observed, but definitely screech owls are most common. And he said, well, that wasn't even an option in the Sibley's for this. And so screech owls are considered rare in the state of Alaska. And in Southeast Alaska, they're not really that rare, but even by those standards, they seem to be more common in Sitka than elsewhere, and I'm not sure why. We don't seem to have very many sawwets. Occasionally, pygmy owls get reported, but And of course, the other owls, great horned owls, occasionally are reported. But yeah, it's interesting that the screech owls just appear to be so common here. And I actually have a recording of one of those also. I'm not sure how loud this one will be, but I'll give it a try. A rainy night. This is starting with single notes.
Mm-hmm.
Let me skip ahead here a little bit.
Oh yeah, there's classic right there.
Yeah. So again, a little bit quiet. So hopefully the people out there listening can hear that. But it's called a bouncing ball call, and it's this accelerating.
Yeah.
I'd try and whistle, but I'm not sure how that'll come across the radio. So
it's hard to whistle that fast, but they're suckers for it. You know, if you imitate it. I've had them outside my house in the middle of the night, and you do it back to them, and the next thing you know, they're flying right past the window.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be fun.
Oh, it's really cool.
Yeah.
And I've never tried it. I have some really good recordings of screech owls that I made out on Middle Island, and I've never tried playing them.
Oh, doing playback?
But, yeah. I mean, if my crude imitation works. You know, another way you can imitate it is by blowing in the top of a bottle, like a beer bottle or something. That can be pretty good, but you just have to be fast, and it accelerates, right?
Right, yeah. Right. And so there are other species that sound similar, including I actually went and listened to that northern hawk owl call, and I was like, well, that does, I mean, it's that kind of whistle trill thing going on, and boreal owl is another one that has that.
Right.
Boreal owl is an owl that I think was one that was hit by a car and turned into the Raptor Center. I believe I remember hearing that. I don't remember for sure. And boreal owls have been seen in Gustavus, but they're another one.
Yeah,
the range is sort of, they're not real sure where they go. You know, owls are just one of those birds, especially if they're, you know, nocturnal owls. Boy, try and find one during the day. I remember when they were doing the owl surveys, and the regular surveys, and the folks that were doing that, Steve Lewis and Michelle Kisling, came and gave a talk. And one of the slides was a picture of a tree. And then, and it was kind of like, well, why'd they put a picture of a tree up there? And he says, do you see the owl?
Oh,
and
yeah.
There was an owl, and it just looked like bark. It was, and the reason they found it was because it had a radio transmit. I mean, they had radio collar. Not a collar exactly, but a harness kind of thing. So they were able to track it and then find the tree that it was in and then figure out where to find it. But it was really hard to see. We were able, the only one I've seen in daylight was this at the beginning of the year, actually around the first of the year. And it was in the neighborhood right along Edelin Street, in somebody's tree by somebody's driveway. And the only reason I found it is because the very thrushes and the juncos and the chickadees were all just upset about
mobbing
something.
Yeah.
And they weren't getting too close, but I was like, there's got to be something there. And so we looked, and sure enough, it was right up against the trunk. And then we could actually see it pretty well. But if it hadn't been for those other birds, there's just no way I would have ever. But I find myself looking in those trees, you know, both there and around. Because I do hear them in the neighborhood sometimes. I go out in the evening and around those neighborhoods, there are owls. I don't know what they're eating. I think somebody did a study. They looked at the stomach contents of birds that had been killed by, you know, vehicle impacts or something like that, and they were finding a surprising amount of insects in them.
Yeah, that was my first thought, and they must be eating insects of some kind. I had a really interesting experience along those lines of using other birds to find an owl. Oh, this was in Australia. There's a little owl that's sort of like a screech owl. It's called a boobook owl, and it goes, ooh, 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 ooh. That's how it gets its name. It's very characteristic, but a really sweet little owl. And I was staying at the home of friends out in the country, and I saw all these birds just going crazy.
Yeah.
This big mob scene. And so I walked very, very carefully because I thought the birds were probably upset about a snake, and there's so many poisonous snakes. So I'm watching my feet.
Yeah.
And the next thing I know, I'm standing right underneath this owl that was really almost close enough to touch.
So were the birds all, were they in all directions, or were they all just strictly above it?
They were, interesting question, Matt. They were mostly above it.
Yeah. See, what I there's the book What the Robin Knows that I was reading, and I've talked to the author quite a bit at various times, and actually he was on the show with you, John Young,
right.
And one of the things that he said is, and I asked him about this. I said, they were, if you look, they'll be in this, and they call that the parabolic alarm, because it's kind of this, umbrella shape.
Mm.
And so what it is, and the size of the parabola has to do with the threat level of the predator.
Like
if it's relatively small, if they're pretty close, then it's probably not. It's a predator they don't like, but they don't feel too threatened by. But if it's a big, then they want to let everybody know it's there, but they don't want to get too close. But they pretty much never go below it, because that puts them at the disadvantage.
Oh, right.
Because it could just drop right down.
How fascinating.
On them. And so you can gauge the level where to look. And I didn't realize that this at the time. When I asked about it later after we'd found this owl, but all the birds were up above it, and the ones that were lower were quite a ways away. And they were sort of a little agitated, but not really insistently alarming. But they were all up in this sort of umbrella shape above the owl. So once I realized where they were all looking, then it made it a lot easier to find
really
the owl.
Really interesting. I had to, you remind me of two experiences in the Brooks Range, and one was hearing birds in a kind of classic boreal forest along the edge of a big lake way out in the wild country of the Brooks Range in northern Alaska. And I heard this birds just melting down, robins and thrushes, and probably there were white-crowned sparrows in there, just all going crazy. And so I recorded it, and then I just started easing toward it.
Yeah.
And that was very cool, because it was a great gray owl.
Oh, yeah.
That they were upset about, which is a very biggest of our owls,
yeah.
Like a big great horned owl without the tufts on its ears. I don't know if they've ever been seen around
there
here.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because somebody else I was talking to this week had said he saw one actually at Stargaven once.
Oh, my gosh.
He was going to the artesian well, and he said it was just right there above the trail. He says there's no mistaking a great gray owl. They're just this huge
thing,
owl.
Yeah, with a big round head.
Yeah, but they're definitely the other record that I've heard of for Sitka, and I don't remember which bay, but I'm thinking it was Sayuk Bay in the 1800s. Somebody shot one.
Wow,
so that was kind of like the other record of those. So they probably occur here once every in a great while. I heard somebody else that thought they might be nesting on Jacobi Island.
Oh, wow.
He had been up there in the winter and had heard them up
there.
Oh,
right.
And so that's another, who knows exactly where. But, yeah, definitely you don't expect to see them here.
Yeah, it's a classic bird of the boreal forest and kind of the great mystery bird, that you don't see very often.
Yeah.
And then the other really neat experience with birds mobbing and raising a big fracas was on the southern part of the Brooks Range along the Alatna River. And this was in a totally different environment of big kind of open muskeg and meadows along a little river. And again, birds just going crazy, but different kinds of birds. These were open country birds. And all this big racket and everything. And that turned out to be a great big black bear.
Oh, interesting.
That the birds, it was nesting time, and the birds just did not like having this black bear around. So it's just another way of, it's this topic that has come up numerous times before, of the animals can lead you to other animals.
Yeah. And, in the What the Robin Knows book, he has a story of moving from the East Coast to the West Coast, and he didn't know what was there, but there were winter wrens. And at the time, they were still the same species, but now they've split the Eastern and the Western. But they were behaving in this way that he associated with weasels. And he asked the guy that lived there, and it was this fairly good-sized acreage, and I think the guy spent a lot of time outside, were there weasels there? And he's like, no, we don't have weasels here. But they just kept acting like this. They ended up finding a weasel nest in an old car, and they found, I can't remember how many voles, but just tons of
weasels
were constantly going in and out. And the birds had it was the manner in which the wrens were alarming reminded him of weasels, and so it was later that he was able to verify that in fact weasels were around and quite active. But
so they're specific had a specific way of reacting to a specific threat.
Yeah, and I think part of it was the weasels come in and out. I mean, they're like visible and then they disappear, and
right.
So that, you know, then they get a little nervous and are sort of hopping around.
Yeah,
it isn't like a constantly visible threat. But weasels are also kind of voracious predators, and I mean, I ran into a mink once that was intimidating to me, and just because the attitude that it gives.
They have a lot of chutzpah there.
Yeah, yeah. And it had been. I saw it was at the park near the river mouth and kind of where the trail goes along the riprap that they put in to stabilize the bank. And the mink came walking across and it had something in his mouth. And I didn't know what it was, but I think it was probably like a winter wren. It was a small bird. It was a small something. It could have been a small vole, I suppose. And it goes around the corner where I can't see it, but this eagle comes flying in. And then I hear this sort of noise going. It was the mink making noise over there. And then the eagle flies off with a little something in its talons. I mean, it was just tiny. I don't know why the eagle even bothered. I walked over there, and the mink was kind of under one of those big rocks, the riprap kind of stuff there. And I walked, and I kind of was walking over it, and it came out, and it seemed really ticked off. And it was like kind of coming at me a little bit and kind of going back in and coming back out again. I was like, okay, I'm going to leave you alone. But it baffled me that the eagle would care. Obviously, the mink had to give it up because the eagle could have taken the mink. Presumably, but it was still really mad at it, and it sounded like it had put up a bit of a fight about it. It would have been fun to actually have been able to see what happened. I don't know what happened. I just saw the eagle fly in and then fly back out with that little something. And when I walked over, the mink didn't have anything anymore. So,
man, never underestimate any member of the weasel family.
Yeah,
they're so amazing.
Yeah, and they're not that hard to observe down, you know, along the shorelines here, the minks.
And that place that you mentioned there, and that riprap along in Totem Park along Indian River is a good place to see mink.
I've seen them running along there, running along the shore. I remember talking to you and you saying you can make little noises. Those kind of noises.
Oh, yeah, it'll drive them crazy. And I spent a winter trapping with a guy up in near the village of Chalkeetsuk in northern Alaska, and he was the trapper I was along to learn some of his knowledge, and he would, on that dry snow, you know, sub-zero, snow gets squeaky, if he saw a mink hole that he thought there might be a mink in there, he would stand next to it and squeak his foot.
Yeah,
in the snow, and they just have this compulsion, you know, this curiosity. But squeaking works a lot. I did it the other day. I was kayaking and I saw this mink running around on a dock and then up onto the deck of a great big boat where I live on Jamestown Bay, and so I squeaked at it, and they just can't help themselves.
Yeah.
They just had to come over and check me out.
Well, I was walking on the breakwater, and I finally remembered to do that, and there were two mink, and they were in the breakwater, in those rocks, and they were running back and forth, and there was two little openings where they could see me, and they'd look up.
Oh, yeah.
And then they'd run back to somewhere else, because I think they obviously didn't want any part of me. But they kept hearing me making that noise, and they wanted to. I mean, it was like that. I guess it's that compulsion they seem to feel. That's a weak prey kind of call.
Yeah, I mean, it must be. And otters will sometimes, river otters land otters will sometimes respond to that, or also land otters sometimes just can't help it if you imitate their call, which sounds exactly like a bird.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of like that. If you do that to them, it'll kind of drive them nuts. You know, they got to see, hey, there's another one of us over there somewhere.
That was something that showed up on the, actually, I have one here, mystery chirps. I'm not sure what these chirps are from a bird or a mammal, but it took me a while to figure out when I was doing my night recordings.
That it was otters?
That it was otters. And they were down by, this is when I lived behind the SJ Museum.
Oh, yeah.
And the otters were down at the flume where that falls on the SJ campus. And they were down there. I think it was kind of this time of year, and there was whatever salmon were still kind of, there wasn't much left, but they would be down in there. And it took me a while to be able to sort them out from the marbled murrelets that would fly over at night.
Oh, right, right. Mm-hmm. And, another whistle.
Yeah, yeah. And it's more, they describe that kind of as a clear call. It's a high-pitched, and it's got a, It's got a more of a tail off at the end than the chirps of the otters.
But. Yeah, they're very short and abrupt. I remember doing it once. I think squeaking at a otter, not in town but out of town, and the otter came up so close that eventually it was gonna come right up my boots, and I sort of had my dog that I was keeping at bay as this big otter came up, and I mean they can be pretty amazing, pretty clear, but mostly not. You know, if you're paddling your kayak and the otters go down, that's what always amazes me. The otter went down, and you sit there and you wait and wait and wait, and you never see it again.
Never come up again.
They're incredible.
Yeah. I don't know how far they can swim underwater, but
I don't know. They're pretty good. You know what you make me think of, Matt, in this conversation, talking about mink in Sitka and otters in Sitka, and of course the same thing would be true in all of the outlying communities that where Raven Radio is heard. Is the amazing wild animals that we can have. And as you say, talking about Edelin Street and right in the middle of town with screech owls and this stuff. And you following in the footsteps of Marge and Tadine, you know, I think showing all of us what a richness we have of birds, and then these other animals. My goodness, I mean, we're sitting at Raven Radio Studio, and we know there's a brown bear within a mile of us right now somewhere.
Yeah.
And of course, black-tailed deer that are, I think, increasingly in people's backyards.
Yeah.
I mean, we're so incredibly privileged, not to mention sea lions in the Harbor Channel and harbor seals.
Yeah.
You and I were talking about the harbor seals off Indian River that they always come in during the salmon season. Man, it's incredible, not to mention killer whales swimming right through the Harbor Channel and humpback whales and gray whales right along the shores of town. I mean, we're so incredibly privileged here.
Some of us, I mean, it's funny. It's like, oh, it's just another sea lion. You know, it's exciting when the killer whales come through and are, you know, attacking the sea lions. But, you know, our standard for you know, wildlife encounters is sometimes perhaps a little higher than it needs to be, the bar for excitement. But
well, yeah, and I mean, and then we shouldn't have this conversation without mentioning the fact that, of course, we have bald eagles all over the place that so many visitors to our community are so excited to see. And then the other thing, underappreciated, I think, in a lot of ways, is the ravens. You know, birds that can live 40 or 50 years that are consistently rated as among the most intelligent birds in the world, the northern raven and then some of the parrots.
Yeah.
You know, being the most intelligent birds and the playfulness of these birds and seeing the ravens like I did once riding in the back of a pickup truck right through the middle of town because there was something to eat in there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's phenomenal.
Yeah. Ravens are kind of fun to... You know, raven behavior and so forth. It's in the book, in the bird language book, they give the what they call the corvid disclaimer, and they said don't try and interpret corvid behavior because they will trick you on purpose sometimes. You know, they will.
They're that clever.
That's what they seem to be doing. They'll be acting like there's something going on, and you'll go over there, and even jays, you know, you go over there and look, and there's nothing, and then it's sort of like they fly off, and you wonder if they're just going ha ha, you know.
Yeah, right.
Gotcha.
Yeah, they're smart, and a lot of people in native communities will say they're a lot smarter than we are.
Yeah.
And it's endlessly fascinating.
And just the array of vocalizations that the ravens here make.
I'm always so curious, you know. I don't know, Matt, have you found any good sources that interpret some of the vocalizations of ravens?
I don't know about interpreting. Marge mentioned to me once that somebody came here working on a master's project or some graduate project on raven vocalizations. And I want to say, I'll have to ask her about it again, but I think, and maybe she has a copy of the paper, but that there was 30 some different vocalizations that they recorded here.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know how much they tried to associate them with particular activities, but you know, there's one call, they do this barrel roll when they're flying, and
they make
this call. It seems like every time I see them do that sort of barrel roll, it comes with this call.
Yeah.
And so that's always kind of interesting. I've wondered about that, you know, why, you know. Just flying over Swan Lake, and it flew over, when it was over the lake, it just kind of made that sort of, not really a full roll, but just a roll, a little flip, and then back, and it made that call just as it flew over the lake, but didn't do it on either side. It was almost like it was kind of having something to do with the lake, but I don't know.
Well, Koyukon people, Athabascan people who I lived with for a few years up in interior Alaska, say that when a raven does that, when the raven flips over like that, and some, if it also says kaka,
yeah,
which is the Athabascan, the Koyukon Athabascan word for animal, kaka.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And they say that when it does that, you should follow it because it's showing you where you'll find game. And I've often done that in deer hunting, and I sort of, I don't know.
Does it work for you?
I think it does.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had written about that, and Baron Heinrich, the great expert on ravens, I was so pleased to see a man of his impeccable scientific credentials quote that.
Yeah.
Take it seriously enough to, in his book, The Mind of the Raven, which is a fabulous book for anybody who hasn't read that book. His books, both Ravens in Winter and The Mind of the Raven. But he does, he quotes it. And of course, Baron Heinrich, that's one of his great interests, is how ravens lead each other, or how do they behave around food?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we could probably fill up a whole hour just on ravens and
crows.
Oh,
without
and
any
things.
Question. The best of all would be to get Baron Heinrich on the phone.
Oh, yeah, that'd be fun. But there was a couple things I wanted to talk about. We're actually just down to about 10 minutes left. So there's a couple things I want to talk about because I'm curious if other people have seen anything. Now, you mentioned the parks, the seals at the park. And so what I had seen in the last week, which I've seen before, and they were gathered up in the, it's at the battle site sign bench area there, and they were right off that kind of end. And if you look out from there towards Eastern Channel, Silver Bay, there's a red buoy, and they were well inside that red buoy. The tide was up fairly high, so I'm guessing they were in five or 6 feet of water at most. And they were all gathered up kind of together. They were sort of milling about in there, up and down a little bit. But when they were up, most of them had their noses pointed up, more like you associate with sea lions, They weren't straight up in the air, but sort of like they were sniffing the breeze kind of thing. And normally seals, they have their head up, and it looks like they're just looking across the surface of the water, sort of periscope style. But they had their noses up in the air. And the last time I noticed that there at the park, I thought, it looks like they're smelling the air is really what it looks like. They're trying to smell something. I had no idea if seals could smell at that time. I wouldn't know why. You don't need to smell underwater, so I didn't know why they would. And I looked into that a little bit. It turns out that apparently they smell their young. And they actually have a pretty good sense of smell. And then also around that same time, I heard of somebody that it was a whale park and saw killer whales came right up, were right in that area. And it wasn't the exact same time, I don't think, but it was roughly the same time. So I started to wonder, I wonder if these harbor seals can smell killer whales, moving or around and recognize them as the killer whales that are a threat to them as opposed to the ones that aren't so much. You see seals along off the park there, but they're not usually gathered together.
Right.
And they don't usually all have their noses up in the air like that.
Yeah, it's the nose up in the air thing that makes you curious.
It's like there, and it wasn't much wind that day. The day that it first time I saw them, the wind was blowing from Eastern Channel. That day it was pretty calm where I was at the park this last week. So I'm curious if anybody around has noticed any killer whales in the last week or so in the Sound. Of course they come through here and you're kind of lucky to see them. They probably move through here fairly often, but they don't spend a lot of time.
Yeah, they're incredibly hard to see actually too when they're around.
So I'm people are getting out. It's been nice weather this week. Maybe people are out on the boat. Maybe somebody has seen them. But the other thing I wanted to mention is this is sort of for folks that don't have the opportunity to go spend the night on Lazaria or something, which I know you've done. If you want to see storm petrels, this is the time of year to see them. If we have strong weather, and even if it's not terrible weather, you're getting out not very far in the boat. It's not like you have to go way out offshore. So the mystery here for me is that most people I've ever talked to have only seen fork-tailed storm petrels on the water. Talked to a couple of people that have seen leeches. And
I saw a couple of fork-tails just a couple of days ago out on the Sound.
Out on the Sound. And I saw some last Sunday, actually, just between here and Pirate's Cove. They weren't really weren't far out. They're just kind of in there. And if the weather blows a little harder, I've seen lots of them.
There will be more. That's right.
In Crescent. I've seen them from the park, really.
Even in the Harbor Channel.
And in the channel, right. From the bridge. And so the fork-tailed storm petrels aren't that hard to observe on the water. From what I've read about the expectation of their ecology is that the leeches go way out offshore and the fork-tails are more likely to feed near shore. But this time of year, I mean, the forktails are in closer. But if that was all there was, then you'd say, okay, well, the leeches are moving offshore. They never come in close to town. But the thing is, I asked the Raptor Center last year, Jen Cedarleaf, said she gave me a spreadsheet of their people have turned in storm petrels. You know, they basically get stranded on land. They come in at night and people find them in their driveways, sort of thing. I've seen dead leeches, storm petrels that seem to have run into lights or something. From year to year, it varies, but overall, they're about half of their birds that they get in are leeches and about half are fork-tailed. And so for whatever reason, the fork-tails and the leeches are both coming into town at night and flying around and getting stranded, you know, not in huge numbers, but regularly. I mean, to the tune of usually a dozen or more a year in total. And so that's probably at night. They're probably coming into the lights. I guess it seems like you said when you're out on Lazaria, when your headlight was on.
Oh, yeah, they'll fly right into your face.
Fly into it. Mm-hmm. So they're attracted to the light. What is it that the leeches are doing? Like, do they then just move way out again during the day, and so people don't see them very much on the water, or do they just sit on the water? Somebody actually just caught one that was in Crescent Harbor, and I talked to her about it, and she may be on the show in a couple of weeks. I'll ask her more about it, but it was barely, like, its head was above water. The rest of it was underwater. She wasn't sure what it was, and it had probably lost its, you know, its oil on its feathers, and then it was still alive though, and they were able to get it to the Raptor Center. And I'm not sure if they were. It sounded like it was doing better last I heard. I don't know if it. I think they may have even then released it. But most of the time, these birds that they find stranded are fine. They just wait until night and then release them. But where are they going? I mean, why is it that nobody's seeing them on the water during the day?
And that's really interesting.
So people are seeing storm petrels. They're a fairly distinctive bird. If you see them up close, they're part of the tube noses. They have an extra little bit on their nose. They have an interesting sort of flight style, right on the water, down and up. And when there's a wind blowing, they actually can soar pretty well right along the water. But if it's a calm day, which is when I usually see them after a storm, a calm day in near Crescent Harbor from the bridge, then they have this interesting sort of flight style where they're up and down.
Down. It's beautiful to see dainty little dancing flight.
Yeah, I don't know how would you. They're a little.
They're
bigger
like
than
a little dove. They're like a little small bodied dove with long kind of delicate wings, and they're just lovely little things.
Yeah, and the fork tails are gray, and the leeches are much darker. They got some patterning on them.
Fork tails are light gray. The leeches would be very dark, ashy gray.
Yeah. And leeches, I guess, are the more abundant on Lazaria, as I recall.
Yeah, right. And they have this incredible voice. Actually, I accidentally heard Encounters this morning on the radio, and you can find it on the website at encountersnorth.org. There's a program about seabirds, and I put two recordings of storm petrels into that program. So if you could always go there if you want to hear what they sound like.
Yeah, it is a kind of a fascinating sort of chittering,
chattering.
Oh, man,
it's just an amazing sound. It's one of the most amazing natural sounds I know of.
Yeah, and I'm just like hundreds of thousands of them moving in and out of the island. I'm pretty sure that those are showing up on the radar, at Bjork Island radar.
Oh,
if you get
a
clear night where there's no precipitation, that you can see. I mean, it doesn't have enough resolution to really be clear, but it looks like from the at the south edge of Kruzov, there's these birds moving in and out, or things, you know, and you get directionality based on.
Well, yeah, if you have several hundred thousand birds in the air, I guess it would show up.
It shows up there. So, and it's interesting to watch the bird migration you can see on the radars. And actually, in the lower 48, you can track the migration with the weather radar. It's actually pretty amazing. And you see them all lift up, you know, in the evening as the sun sets, and then set down in the morning, and then they'll be different depending on the weather systems and so forth. So it's becoming, I think they're kind of becoming a science a bit as they start to tune and be able to tell what the response on the radar is, you know, what kind of birds this might be or the density of the birds. So,
well, you know, it reminds me to say you can't mention often enough the writing of Scott Wiedensahl and his book on bird migration, his great tome on. I'm just blanking.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, man.
I have to look at it.
Oh, it's incredible. I think it's called Living on the Wing or something like that. His name is Scott Wiedensahl, Wiedensahul, and he's a really fine writer. And this book is the magnum opus, the brilliant book about bird migration. Yeah. Really worth checking. Oh, Matt, you'd love this book.
I'll have to look for it. We're kind of winding down here, so I want to say if anybody's seen any storm petrels at night or anything like that, I'd definitely be interested in hearing about them. Of course, if you find them stranded, the Raptor Center will take them and check them out and then release them. Want to remind everybody that you can I'm a little behind in posting past shows, but you can post a look at past shows and at sitkanature.org/raven. Or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page on Facebook. I also will post the links to the recordings there. I want to thank Richard for coming in and talking. The hour goes by fast. It seems like there's always way more to talk about than time to talk about it, but that's part of what makes it so fun, endlessly fascinating.
It is, absolutely. It's always a pleasure, Matt. Thank you so much, and thanks for the show. A lot of us just love to listen.
Well, I'm glad. You know, it's always my motivation for doing it was hoping that people would realize that there are other folks out there interested in what's going on and what they're seeing. And I know that, like I said at the beginning of the show, I'm really grateful for the folks that have taken the time out to, you know, share their observations with me and others, you know, either personally directly when I see them or via the Sitka Birds email list. If you're interested in getting on the Sitka Birds email list, you can go to sitkanature.org, and there is a link there to subscribe to the Sitka Birds email list. I know you've posted there in the past.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, if you're interested in birds at all, get on there because you'll find out what's going on around here.
Yep, you don't have to post if you don't want to. Most people that are subscribed just read, but it's great.